town lived as if it had no future. As for Dr. Rieu, that brief hour of peace and friendship which had been granted him wasn't and couldn't be repeated. Yet another hospital had been opened, and his only converse was with his patients. However, he noticed a change at this stage of the epidemic. Now that the plague was assuming more and more the pneumonic form, the patients seemed, after their fashion, to be seconding the doctor. Instead of giving way to the prostration or the frenzies of the early period, they appeared to have a clear idea of where their interests lay, and on their own initiative asked for what might be most beneficial. Thus, they were always clamoring for something to drink and insisted on being kept as warm as possible. And though the demands on him were as exhausting as before, Rieu no longer had the impression of putting up a solitary fight. The patients were cooperating. Toward the end of December, he received a letter from Monsieur Auton, who was still in quarantine. The magistrate stated that his quarantine period was over. Unfortunately, the date of his admission to camp seemed to have been mislaid by the secretariat. And if he was still detained, it was certainly due to a mistake. His wife, recently released from quarantine, had gone to the prefect's office to protest, and had been rudely treated. They had told her that the office never made mistakes. Rieu asked Rambert to look into the matter, and a few days later Monsieur Auton called on him. There had, in fact, been a mistake, and Rieu showed some indignation. But Monsieur Auton, who had grown thinner, raised a limp, deprecating hand. Weighing his words, he said that everyone could make mistakes. And the doctor thought to himself that decidedly something had changed. "What will you do now, Monsieur Auton?" Rieu asked. "I suppose you have a pile of work awaiting you."
"Well, as a matter of fact, I'm putting in for some leave."
"I quite understand. You need a rest."
"It's not that.
I want to go back to the camp."
Rieu couldn't believe his ears.
"But you've only just come out of it."
"I'm afraid I didn't make myself clear.
I'm told there are some voluntary workers from government offices in that camp." The magistrate rolled his round eyes a little and tried to smooth down a tuft of hair. "It would keep me busy, you see. And also, I know it may sound absurd, but I'd feel less separated from my little boy." Rieu stared at him. Could it be that a sudden gentleness showed in those hard, inexpressive eyes? Yes, they had grown misted, lost their steely glitter.
"Certainly," Rieu said. "Since that's your wish, I'll fix it up for you."
The doctor kept his word, and the life of the plague-ridden town resumed its course until Christmas. Theroux continued to bring his quiet efficiency to bear on every problem. Rambert confided in the doctor that, with the connivance of the two young guards, he was sending letters to his wife and now and then receiving an answer. He suggested to Rieu that he should avail himself of this clandestine channel, and Rieu agreed to do so. For the first time for many months, he sat down to write a letter. He found it a laborious business, as if he were manipulating a language that he had forgotten. The letter was dispatched. The reply was slow in coming. As for Cottard, he was prospering, making money hand over fist in small, somewhat shady transactions. With Grand, however, it was otherwise. The Christmas season didn't seem to agree with him. Indeed, Christmas that year had none of its old-time associations. It smacked of hell rather than of heaven.
Empty, unlighted shops. Dummy chocolates or empty boxes in the confectioner's windows. Streetcars laden with listless, dispirited passengers. All was as unlike Christmastides as it well could be. In the past, all the townspeople, rich and poor alike, indulged in seasonable festivity. Now only a privileged few, those with money to burn, could do so, and they caroused in shame-faced solitude in a dingy back shop or a private room. In the churches there were more supplications than carols. You saw a few children, too young to realize what threatened them, playing in the frosty, cheerless streets. But no one dared to bid them welcome in the God of former days, bringer of gifts, and old as human sorrow, yet new as the hopes of youth. There was no room in any heart but for a very old, gray hope. That hope which keeps men from letting themselves drift into death and is nothing but a dogged will to live. Grant had failed to show up as usual on the previous evening. Feeling somewhat anxious, Rieu called at his place early in the morning, but he wasn't at home. His friends were asked to keep a lookout for him. At about 11, Rambert came to the hospital with the news that he'd had a distant glimpse of Grant, who seemed to be wandering aimlessly, looking very queer. Unfortunately, he had lost sight of him almost at once. Tarou and the doctor set out in the car to hunt for Grant. At noon, Rieu stepped out of his car into the frozen air. He had just caught sight of Grand some distance away, his face glued to a shop window full of crudely carved wooden toys. Tears were steadily flowing down the old fellow's cheeks, and they wrung the doctor's heart, for he could understand them, and he felt his own tears welling up in sympathy. A picture rose before him of that scene of long ago. The youngster standing in front of another shop window, like this one dressed for Christmas, and Jeanne turning toward him in a sudden access of emotion and saying how happy she was. He could guess that through the mists of the past years, from the depth of his fond despair. Jeanne's young voice was rising, echoing in Grand's ears. And he knew also what the old man was thinking as his tears flowed. And he, Rieu, thought it too, that a loveless world is a dead world. And always there comes an hour when one is weary of prisons, of one's work, and of devotion to duty, and all one craves for is a loved face, the warmth and wonder of a loving heart. Grand saw the doctor's reflection in the window. Still weeping, he turned and, leaning against the shop front, watched Rieu approach.
"Oh, doctor, doctor,"
he could say no more. Rieu, too, couldn't speak. He made a vague, understanding gesture. At this moment he suffered with Grand sorrow, and what filled his breast was the passionate indignation we feel when confronted by the anguish all men share. "Yes, Grand," he murmured.
"Oh, if only I could have time to write to her, to let her know, and to let her be happy without remorse."
Almost roughly, Rieu took Grand's arm and drew him forward. Grand didn't resist and went on muttering broken phrases.
"Too long. It's lasted too long. All the time one's wanting to let oneself go. And then one day one has to. Oh, doctor, I know I look a quiet sort, just like anybody else, but it's always been a terrible effort only to be just normal. And now, well, even that's too much for me."
He stopped dead. He was trembling violently. His eyes were fever bright. Rieu took his hand. It was burning hot. You must go home. But Gron wrenched himself free and started running. After a few steps, he halted and stretched out his arms, swaying to and fro. Then he spun round on himself and fell flat on the pavement, his face stained with the tears that went on flowing. Some people who were approaching stopped abruptly and watched the scene from a little way off, not daring to come near. Ryu had to carry the old man to the car. Gron lay in bed, gasping for breath. His lungs were congested. Ryu pondered. The old fellow hadn't any family. What would be the point of having him evacuated? He and Taru could look after him. Gron's head was buried in the pillow. His cheeks were a greenish-gray. His eyes had gone dull, opaque. He seemed to be gazing fixedly at the scanty fire Taru was kindling with the remains of an old packing case.
"I'm in a bad way," he muttered.
A queer crackling sound came from his flame-seared lungs whenever he tried to speak. Ryu told him not to talk and promised to come back. The sick man's lips parted in a curious smile, and a look of humorous complicity flickered across the haggard face.
"If I pull through, Doctor... hats off."
A moment later, he sank into extreme prostration. Visiting him again some hours later, they found him half sitting up in bed, and Ryu was horrified by the rapid change that had come over his face, ravaged by the fires of the disease consuming him. However, he seemed more lucid and almost immediately asked them to get his manuscript from the drawer where he always kept it. When Taru handed him the sheets, he pressed them to his chest without looking at them, then held them out to the doctor, indicating by a gesture that he was to read them. There were some 50 pages of manuscript. Glancing through them, Ryu saw that the bulk of the writing consisted of the same sentence written again and again with small variants, simplifications or elaborations. Persistently, the month of May, the lady on horseback, the avenues of the Bois recurred, regrouped in different patterns. There were, besides, explanatory notes, some exceedingly long, and lists of alternatives. But at the foot of the last page was written in a studiously clear hand,
"My dearest Jean, today is Christmas Day, and—"
8 words only. Above it, in copperplate script, was the latest version of the famous phrase.
"Read it,"
Gron whispered. And Ryu read. One fine morning in May, a slim young horsewoman might have been seen riding a glossy sorrel mare along the avenues of the Bois, among the flowers.
"Is that it?"
There was a feverish quaver in the old voice. Ryu refrained from looking at him, and he began to toss about in the bed.
"Yes, I know. I know what you're thinking. Fine isn't the word. It's—"
Ryu clasped his hand under the coverlet.
"No, doctor. It's too late. No time."
His breast heaved painfully, then suddenly he said in a loud, shrill voice,
"Burn it!"
The doctor hesitated, but Gron repeated his injunction in so violent a tone and with such agony in his voice that Ryu walked across to the fireplace and dropped the sheets on the dying fire. It blazed up, and there was a sudden flood of light, a fleeting warmth in the room. When the doctor came back to the bed, Gron had his back turned, his face almost touching the wall. After injecting the serum, Ryu whispered to his friend that Gron wouldn't last the night, and Teru volunteered to stay with him. The doctor approved. All night, Ryu was haunted by the idea of Gron's death. But next morning he found his patient sitting up in bed, talking to Teru. His temperature was down to normal, and there were no symptoms other than a generalized prostration.
"Yes, doctor," Gron said. "I was over hasty. But I'll make another start. You'll see, I can remember every word."
Ryu looked at Teru dubiously. "We must wait," he said. But at noon, there was no change. By nightfall, Gron could be considered out of danger. Ryu was completely baffled by this resurrection. Other surprises were in store for him. About the same time, there was brought to the hospital a girl whose case Ryu diagnosed as hopeless, and he had sent her immediately to the isolation ward. She was delirious and had all the symptoms of pneumonic plague. Next morning, however, the temperature had fallen. As in Gron's case, the doctor assumed this was the ordinary morning fall that his experience had taught him to regard as a bad sign. But at noon, her temperature still showed no rise, and at night it went up only a few degrees. Next morning, it was down to normal. Though very exhausted, the girl was breathing freely. Ryu remarked to Teru that her recovery was against all the rules. But in the course of the next week, 4 similar cases came to his notice. The old asthma patient was bubbling over with excitement when Ryu and Teru visited him at the end of the week.
"Would you ever have believed it? They're coming out again," he said.
"Who?"
"Why, the rats."
Not one dead or living rat had been seen in the town since April. "Does that mean it's starting all over again?" Teru asked Ryu. The old man was rubbing his hands.
"You should see him running, doctor. It's a treat, it is."
He himself had seen 2 rats slipping into the house by the street door, and some neighbors, too, had told him they'd seen rats in their basements. In some houses, people had heard those once familiar scratchings and rustlings behind the woodwork. Ryu awaited with much interest the mortality figures that were announced every Monday. They showed a decrease. Part 5. Though this sudden setback of the plague was as welcome as it was unlooked for, our townsfolk were in no hurry to jubilate. While intensifying their desire to be set free, the terrible months they had lived through had taught them prudence, and they had come to count less and less on a speedy end of the epidemic. All the same, this new development was the talk of the town, and people began to nurse hopes none the less heartfelt for being unavowed. All else took a back place, that daily there were new victims counted for little beside that staggering fact. The weekly total showed a decrease. One of the signs that a return was the talk of the town, and people began to nurse hopes none the less heartfelt for being unavowed. All else took a back place, that daily there were new victims counted for little beside that staggering fact. The weekly total showed a decrease. One of the signs that a return to the golden age of health was secretly awaited was that our fellow citizens, careful though they were not to voice their hope, now began to talk, in, it's true, a carefully detached tone, of the new order of life that would set in after the plague. All agreed that the amenities of the past couldn't be restored at once, Destruction is an easier, speedier process than reconstruction. However, it was thought that a slight improvement in the food supply could safely be counted on, and this would relieve what was just now the acutest worry of every household. But in reality, behind these mild aspirations lurked wild, extravagant hopes, and often one of us, becoming aware of this, would hastily add that, even on the rosiest view, you couldn't expect the plague to stop from one day to another. Actually, while the epidemic didn't stop from one day to another, it declined more rapidly than we could reasonably have expected. With the first week of January, an unusually persistent spell of very cold weather settled in and seemed to crystallize above the town. Yet never before had the sky been so blue. Day after day, its icy radiance flooded the town with a brilliant light, and in frost-cleansed air, the epidemic seemed to lose its virulence. And in each of 3 consecutive weeks, a big drop in the death roll was announced. Thus, over a relatively brief period, the disease lost practically all the gains piled up over many months. Its setbacks with seemingly predestined victims, like Grand, Andrea's girl patient, its bursts of activity for 2 or 3 days in some districts, synchronizing with its total disappearance from others. Its new practice of multiplying its victims on, say, a Monday, and on Wednesday letting almost all escape. In short, its accesses of violence followed by spells of complete inactivity. All these gave an impression that its energy was flagging, out of exhaustion and exasperation, and it was losing, with its self-command, the ruthless, almost mathematical efficiency that had been its trump card hitherto. Of a sudden, Castel's anti-plague injections scored frequent successes, denied it until now. Indeed, all the treatments the doctors had tentatively employed, without definite results, now seemed almost uniformly efficacious. It was as if the plague had been hounded down and cornered, and its sudden weakness lent new strength to the blunted weapon so far used against it. Only at rare moments did the disease brace itself and make, as it were, a blind and fatal leap at 3 of 4 patients whose recovery had been expected. A truly ill-starred few, killed off when hope ran highest. Such was the case of Monsieur Auton, the magistrate, evacuated from the quarantine camp. Theroux said of him that he'd had no luck, but one couldn't tell if he had in mind the life or the death of Monsieur Auton. But generally speaking, the epidemic was in retreat all along the line. The official communiques, which had at first encouraged no more than shadowy, half-hearted hopes, now confirmed the popular belief that the victory was won, and the enemy abandoning his positions. Really, however, it's doubtful if this could be called a victory. All that could be said was that the disease seemed to be leaving as unaccountably as it had come. Our strategy had not changed, but whereas yesterday it had obviously failed, today it seemed triumphant. Indeed, one's chief impression was that the epidemic had called a retreat after reaching all its objectives. It had, so to speak, achieved its purpose. Nevertheless, it seemed as if nothing had changed in the town. Silent as ever by day, the streets filled up at nightfall with the usual crowds of people, now wearing overcoats and scarves. Cafes and picture houses did as much business as before. But on a closer view, you might notice that people looked less strained, and they occasionally smiled. And this brought home the fact that since the outbreak of plague, no one had hitherto been seen to smile in public. The truth was that for many months the town had been stifling under an airless shroud, in which a rent had now been made. And every Monday when he turned on the radio, each of us learned that the rift was widening. Soon, he would be able to breathe freely. It was, at best, a negative solace, with no immediate impact on men's lives. Still, had anyone been told a month earlier that a train had just left, or a boat put in, or that cars were to be allowed on the streets again, the news would have been received with looks of incredulity. Whereas in mid-January, an announcement of this kind would have caused no surprise. The change, no doubt, was slight. Yet, however slight, it proved what a vast forward stride our townsfolk had made in the way of hope. And indeed, it could be said that once the faintest stirring of hope became possible, the dominion of the plague was ended. It must, however, be admitted that our fellow citizens' reactions during that month were diverse to the point of incoherence. More precisely, they fluctuated between high optimism and extreme depression. Hence the odd circumstance that several more attempts to escape took place at the very moment when the statistics were most encouraging. This took the authorities by surprise, and apparently the sentries too, since most of the escapists brought it off. But looking into it, one saw that people who tried to escape at this time were prompted by quite understandable motives. Some of them, plague had imbued with a skepticism so thorough that it was now a second nature. They had become allergic to hope in any form. Thus, even when the plague had run its course, they went on living by its standards. They were, in short, behind the times. In the case of others, chiefly those who had been living until now in forced separation from those they loved, the rising wind of hope, after all these months of durance and depression, had fanned impatience to a blaze and swept away their self-control. They were seized with a sort of panic at the thought that they might die so near the goal and never see again the ones they loved, and their long privation have no recompense. Thus, though for weary months and months they had endured their long ordeal with dogged perseverance, the first thrill of hope had been enough to shatter what fear and hopelessness had failed to impair. And in the frenzy of their haste, they tried to outstrip the plague, incapable of keeping pace with it up to the end. Meanwhile, there were various symptoms of the growing optimism. Prices, for instance, fell sharply. The fall was unaccountable from the purely economic viewpoint. Our difficulties were as great as ever, the gates were kept rigorously closed, and the food situation was far from showing any improvement. Thus it was a purely psychological reaction, as if the dwindling of the plague must have repercussions in all fields. Others, to profit by the spread of optimism, were those who used to live in groups and had been forced to live apart. The two convents reopened, and their communal life was resumed. The troops, too, were regrouped in such barracks as hadn't been requisitioned, and settled down to the garrison life of the past. Minor details, but significant. This state of subdued yet active ferment prevailed until January 25, when the weekly total showed so striking a decline that, after consulting the medical board, the authorities announced that the epidemic could be regarded as definitely stemmed. True, the communique went on to say that, acting with a prudence of which the population would certainly approve, the prefect had decided that the gates of the town were to remain closed for 2 weeks more, and the prophylactic measures to remain in force for another month. During this period, at the least sign of danger, the standing orders would be strictly enforced and, if necessary, prolonged thereafter for such a period as might be deemed desirable. All, however, concurred in regarding these phrases as mere official verbiage, and the night of January 25 was the occasion of much festivity. To associate himself with the popular rejoicings, The prefect gave orders for the street lighting to be resumed as in the past. And the townspeople paraded the brilliantly lighted streets in boisterous groups, laughing and singing. True, in some houses the shutters remained closed, and those within listened in silence to the joyful shouts outside. Yet even in these houses of mourning, a feeling of deep relief prevailed. Whether because at last the fear of seeing other members of the household taken from them was calmed, or because the shadow of personal anxiety was lifted from their hearts. The families that perforce withdrew themselves the most from the general jubilation were those who at this hour had one of their members down with plague in hospital, and whether in a quarantine camp or at home, waited in enforced seclusion for the epidemic to have done with them as it had done with the others. No doubt these families had hopes, but they hoarded them and forbade themselves to draw on them before feeling quite sure they were justified. And this time of waiting in silence and exile, in a limbo between joy and grief, seemed still crueler for the gladness all around them. But these exceptions didn't diminish the satisfaction of the great majority. No doubt the plague wasn't yet ended, a fact of which they were to be reminded. Still, in imagination, they could already hear, weeks in advance, trains whistling on their way to an outside world that had no limit, and steamers hooting as they put out from the harbor across shining seas. Next day, these fancies would have passed and qualms of doubt returned. But for the moment, the whole town was on the move, quitting the dark, lugubrious confines where it had struck its roots of stone, and setting forth at last, like a shipload of survivors, toward a land of promise. That night, Tarue, Rieu, Rambert, and their colleagues joined for a while the marching crowds, and they too felt as if they trod on air. Long after they had turned off the main streets, even when, in empty byways, they walked past shuttered houses, the joyful clamor followed them up. And because of their fatigue, somehow they couldn't disassociate the sorrow behind those closed shutters from the joy filling the central streets. Thus, the coming liberation had a twofold aspect, of happiness and tears. At one moment, when the cries of exultation in the distance were swelling to a roar, Tarue stopped abruptly. A small, sleek form was scampering along the roadway. A cat. The first cat any of them had seen since the spring. It stopped in the middle of the road, hesitated, licked a paw, and quickly passed it behind its right ear. Then it started forward again and vanished into the darkness. Tarue smiled to himself. The little old man on the balcony, too, would be pleased. But in those days when the plague seemed to be retreating, slinking back to the obscure lair from which it had stealthily emerged, at least one person in the town viewed this retreat with consternation, if Tarue's notes are to be trusted. And that man was Cottard. To tell the truth, these diary notes take a rather curious turn from the date on which the death returns began to drop. The handwriting becomes much harder to read. This may have been due to fatigue. And the diarist jumps from one topic to another without transition. What's more, these later notes lack the objectivity of the earlier ones. Personal considerations creep in. Thus, sandwiched between long passages dealing with the case of Cottard, we find a brief account of the old man and the cats. Tarue conveys to us that the plague had in no wise lessened his appreciation of the old fellow, who continued equally to interest him after the epidemic had run its course. Unfortunately, he couldn't go on interesting him. And this through no lack of good intentions on Taru's part. He had done his best to see him again. Some days after that memorable 25th of January, he stationed himself at the corner of the little street. The cats were back at their usual places, basking in the patches of sunlight. But at the ritual hour, the shutters stayed closed. And never once did Taru see them open on the following days. He drew the rather odd conclusion that the old fellow was either dead or vexed. If vexed, the reason being that he had thought that he was right, and the plague had put him in the wrong. If dead, the question was, as in the case of the old asthmatic, had he been a saint? Taru hardly thought so, but he found in the old man's case a pointer. Perhaps, he wrote, we can only reach approximations of sainthood, in which case we must make shift with a mild, benevolent diabolism. Interspersed with observations relating to Cottard, or remarks scattered here and there, about Grand, he was now convalescent and had gone back to work as if nothing had happened, and about Rieu's mother. The occasional conversations he had with her, when living under the same roof, the old lady's attitudes, her opinions on the plague, are all recorded in detail in the diary. Taru lays stress above all on Madame Rieu's self-effacement, her way of explaining things in the simplest possible words, her predilection for a special window at which she always sat in the early evening, holding herself rather straight, her hands at rest, her eyes fixed on the quiet street below, until twilight filled the room, and she showed among the gathering shadows as a motionless black form which gradually merged into the invading darkness. He remarks on the lightness with which she moved from one room to the other. On her kindness, though no precise instances had come to his notice, he discerned its gentle glow in all she said and did. On the gift she had of knowing everything without, apparently, taking thought. And lastly, that, dim and silent though she was, she quailed before no light, even the garish light of the plague. At this point, Taru's handwriting began to fall off oddly. Indeed, the following lines were almost illegible. And, as if in confirmation of this loss of grip upon himself, the last lines of the entry deal, for the first time in the diary, with his personal life. She reminds me of my mother. What I loved most in mother was her self-effacement, her dimness, as they say. And it's she I've always wanted to get back to. It happened 8 years ago, but I can't say she died. She only effaced herself a trifle more than usual. And when I looked round, she was no longer there. But to return to Cottard. When the weekly totals began to show a decline, he visited Rieu several times on various pretexts. But obviously what he really wanted was to get from Rieu his opinion on the probable course of the epidemic. "Do you really think it can stop like that, all of a sudden?" He was skeptical about this, or anyhow professed to be. But the fact that he kept on asking the question seemed to imply he was less sure than he professed to be. From the middle of January, Rieu gave him fairly optimistic answers. But these weren't to Cottard's liking, and his reactions varied on each occasion from mere petulance to great despondency. One day the doctor was moved to tell him that, though the statistics were highly promising, it was too soon to say definitely that we were out of the wood. "In other words," Cottard said promptly, "there's no knowing. It may start again at any moment." Quite so. Just as it's equally possible the improvement may speed up. Distressing to everyone else, this state of uncertainty seemed to agree with Kotar. Taru observed that he would enter into conversations with shopkeepers in his part of the town, with the obvious desire of propagating the opinion expressed by Rhea. Indeed, he had no trouble in doing this. After the first exhilaration following the announcement of the plague's decline had worn off, doubts had returned to many minds. And the sight of their anxiety reassured Kotar. Just as at other times he yielded to discouragement. "Yes," he said gloomily to Taru. "One of these days the gates will be opened. And then you'll see. They'll drop me like a live coal." Everyone was struck by his abrupt changes of mood during the first 3 weeks of January. Though normally he spared no pains to make himself liked by neighbors and acquaintances, now, for whole days, he deliberately cold-shouldered them. On these occasions, so Taru gathered, he abruptly cut off outside contacts and retired morosely into his shell. He was no more to be seen in restaurants or at the theater or in his favorite cafes. However, he seemed unable to resume the obscure humdrum life he had led before the epidemic. He stayed in his room and had his meal sent up from a nearby restaurant. Only at nightfall did he venture forth to make some small purchases, and on leaving the shop, he would furtively roam the darker, less frequented streets. Once or twice, Taru ran into him on these occasions, but failed to elicit more than a few gruff monosyllables. Then, from one day to another, he became sociable again, talked volubly about the plague, asking everyone for his views on it, and mingled in the crowd with evident pleasure. On January 25, the day of the official announcement, Kotar went to cover again. 2 days later, Taru came across him loitering in a side street. When Kotar suggested he should accompany him home, Taru demurred. He'd had a particularly tiring day. But Kotar wouldn't hear of a refusal. He seemed much agitated, gesticulated freely, spoke very rapidly and in a very loud tone. He began by asking Taru if he really thought the official communique meant an end of the plague. Taru replied that obviously a mere official announcement couldn't stop an epidemic. But it certainly looked as if, barring accidents, it would shortly cease. "Yes," Kotar said, "barring accidents. And accidents will happen, won't they?" Taru pointed out that the authorities had allowed for that possibility by refusing to open the gates for another fortnight. "And very wise they were," Kotar exclaimed in the same excited tone. "By the way things are going, I should say they'll have to eat their words." Taru agreed that this might be so. Still, he thought it wiser to count on the opening of the gates and a return to normal life in the near future. "Granted," Kotar rejoined. "But what do you mean by a return to normal life?" Taru smiled. "New films at the picture houses." But Kotar didn't smile. "Was it supposed," he asked, "that the plague wouldn't have changed anything and the life of the town would go on as before, exactly as if nothing had happened?" Taru thought that the plague would have changed things and not changed them. Naturally, our fellow citizens' strongest desire was, and would be, to behave as if nothing had changed, and for that reason nothing would be changed, in a sense. But to look at it from another angle, one can't forget everything, however great one's wish to do so. The plague was bound to leave traces anyhow in people's hearts. To this Kotar rejoined curtly that he wasn't interested in hearts. Indeed, they were the last thing he bothered about. What interested him was knowing whether the whole administration wouldn't be changed, lock, stock, and barrel. Whether, for instance, the public services would function as before. Taru had to admit he had no inside knowledge on the matter. His personal theory was that after the upheaval caused by the epidemic, there would be some delay in getting these services underway again. Also, it seemed likely that all sorts of new problems would arise and necessitate at least some reorganization of the administrative system. Kotar nodded.
Yes, that's quite on the cards. In fact, everyone will have to make a fresh start.
They were nearing Kotar's house. He now seemed more cheerful, determined to take a rosier view of the future. Obviously, he was picturing the town entering on a new lease of life, blotting out its past and starting again with a clean sheet. So that's that, Daru smiled. Quite likely, things will pan out all right for you, too. Who can say? It'll be a new life for all of us, in a manner of speaking. They were shaking hands at the door of the apartment house where Kotar lived.
Quite right.
Kotar was growing more and more excited.
That would be a great idea, starting again with a clean sheet.
Suddenly, from the lightless hall, two men emerged. Taru had hardly time to hear his companion mutter,
"Now, what do those birds want?"
When the men in question, who looked like subordinate government employees in their best clothes, cut in with an inquiry if his name was Kotar. With a stifled exclamation, Kotar swung round and dashed off into the darkness. Taken by surprise, Taru and the two men gazed blankly at each other for some moments. Then Taru asked them what they wanted. In noncommittal tones, they informed him that they wanted some information, and walked away, unhurrying, in the direction Kotar had taken. On his return home, Taru wrote out an account of this peculiar incident, following it up with a "feeling very tired tonight," which is confirmed by his handwriting in this entry. He added that he had still much to do, but that was no reason for not holding himself in readiness. And he questioned if he were ready, as a sort of postscript, and in fact it's here that Taru's diary ends. He noted that there's always a certain hour of the day and of the night when a man's courage is at its lowest ebb. And it was that hour only that he feared. When next day, a few days before the date fixed for the opening of the gates, Dr. Ryu came home at noon, he was wondering if the telegram he was expecting had arrived. Though his days were no less strenuous than at the height of the epidemic, the prospect of imminent release had obliterated his fatigue. Hope had returned, and with it, a new zest for life. No man can live on the stretch all the time, with his energy and willpower strained to the breaking point, and it's a joy to be able to relax at last and loosen nerves and muscles that were braced for the struggle. If the telegram, too, that he awaited brought good news, Ryu would be able to make a fresh start. Indeed, he had a feeling that everyone in those days was making a fresh start. He walked past the concierge's room in the hall. The new man, old Michel's successor, his face pressed to the window looking on the hall, gave him a smile. As he went up the stairs, the man's face, pale with exhaustion and privation, but smiling, hovered before his eyes. Yes, he'd make a fresh start once the period of abstractions was over. And with any luck, he was opening the door with these thoughts in his mind when he saw his mother coming down the hall to meet him. Monsieur Taru, she told him, wasn't well. He had risen at the usual time, but didn't feel up to going out and had returned to bed. Madame Rieu felt worried about him. Quite likely it's nothing serious, her son said. Taru was lying on his back, his heavy head deeply indenting the pillow, the coverlet bulging above his massive chest. His head was aching and his temperature up. The symptoms weren't very definite, he told Rieu, but they might well be those of plague. After examining him, Rhea said, "No, there's nothing definite as yet." But Teru also suffered from a raging thirst. And in the hallway, the doctor told his mother that it might be plague.
"Oh," she exclaimed. "Surely that's not possible, not now."
And after a moment added,
"Let's keep him here, Bernard."
Ryu pondered. "Strictly speaking, I've no right to do that," he said doubtfully. "Still, the gates will be open quite soon. If you weren't here, I think I'd take it on myself."
"Bernard, let him stay, and let me stay too. You know, I've just had another inoculation."
The doctor pointed out that Teru, too, had had inoculations. Though it was possible, tired as he was, he'd overlooked the last one or omitted to take the necessary precautions. Ryu was going to the surgery as he spoke. And when he returned to the bedroom, Teru noticed that he had a box of the big ampules containing the serum.
"Ah, so it is that," he said. "Not necessarily, but we mustn't run any risks."
Without replying, Teru extended his arm and submitted to the prolonged injections he himself had so often administered to others. "We'll judge better this evening." Rhea looked Teru in the eyes.
"But what about isolating me, Rhea?
It's by no means certain that you have plague." Teru smiled with an effort.
"Well, it's the first time I've known you to do the injection without ordering the patient off to the isolation ward."
Rhea looked away. "You'll be better here. My mother and I will look after you." Teru said nothing, and the doctor, who was putting away the ampules in the box, waited for him to speak before looking round. But still, Teru said nothing, and finally Ryu went up to the bed. The sick man was gazing at him steadily, and though his face was drawn, the gray eyes were calm. Ryu smiled down on him. "Now try to sleep. I'll be back soon." As he was going out, he heard Teru calling and turned back. Teru's manner had an odd effect, as though he were at once trying to keep back what he had to say and forcing himself to say it.
"Ryu," he said at last, "you must tell me the whole truth. I count on that."
"I promise it." Teru's heavy face relaxed in a brief smile.
"Thanks. I don't want to die, and I shall put up a fight. But if I lose the match, I want to make a good end of it."
Bending forward, Ryu pressed his shoulder.
"No. To become a saint, you need to live. So fight away."
In the course of that day, the weather, which after being very cold had grown slightly milder, broke in a series of violent hailstorms followed by rain. At sunset, the sky cleared a little, and it was bitterly cold again. Ryu came home in the evening, his overcoat still on. He entered his friend's bedroom. Teru didn't seem to have moved, but his set lips, drained white by fever, told of the effort he was keeping up.
"Well?" Ryu asked.
Teru raised his broad shoulders a little out of the bedclothes.
"Well," he said, "I'm losing the match."
The doctor bent over him. Ganglia had formed under the burning skin, and there was a rumbling in his chest, like the sound of a hidden forge. The strange thing was that Teru showed symptoms of both varieties of plague at once. Ryu straightened up and said the serum hadn't yet had time to take effect. An uprush of fever in his throat drowned the few words that Teru tried to utter. After dinner, Ryu and his mother took up their posts at the sick man's bedside. The night began with a struggle, and Rhea knew that this grim wrestling with the Angel of Plague was to last until dawn. In this struggle, Taru's robust shoulders and chest weren't his greatest assets. Rather, the blood that had spurted under Rhea's needle. And in this blood, that's something more vital than the soul, which no human skill can bring to light. The doctor's task could be only to watch his friend struggle. As to what he was about to do, the stimulants to inject, the abscesses to stimulate, many months' repeated failures had taught him to appreciate such expedients at their true value. Indeed, the only way in which he might help was to provide opportunities for the beneficence of chance, which too often stays dormant unless roused to action. Luck was an ally he could not dispense with. For Ryu was confronted by an aspect of the plague that baffled him. Yet again, it was doing all it could do to confound the tactics used against it. It launched attacks in unexpected places and retreated from those where it seemed definitely lodged. Once more, it was out to darken council. Taru struggled without moving. Not once in the course of the night did he counter the enemy's attacks by restless agitation. Only with all his stolid bulk, with silence, did he carry on the fight. Nor did he even try to speak, thus intimating after his fashion that he could no longer let his attention stray. Rieu could follow the vicissitudes of the struggle only in his friend's eyes, now open and now shut. In the eyelids, now more closely welded to the eyeball, now distended, and in his gaze fixed on some object in the room or brought back to the doctor and his mother. And each time it met the doctor's gaze, with a great effort, Taru smiled. At one moment there came a sound of hurrying footsteps in the street. They were in flight before a distant throbbing which gradually approached until the street was loud with the clamor of the downpour. Another rain squall was sweeping the town, mingled presently with hailstones that clattered on the sidewalk. Window awnings were flapping wildly. Rhea, whose attention had been diverted momentarily by the noises of the squall, looked again across the shadows at Taru's face, on which fell the light of a small bedside lamp. His mother was knitting, raising her eyes now and then from her work to gaze at the sick man. The doctor had done everything that could be done. When the squall had passed, the silence in the room grew denser, filled only by the silent turmoil of the unseen battle. His nerves overwrought by sleeplessness, the doctor fancied he could hear, on the edge of the silence, that faint, eerie sibilance which had haunted his ears ever since the beginning of the epidemic. He made a sign to his mother, indicating she should go to bed. She shook her head, and her eyes grew brighter. Then she examined carefully at her needle tips, a stitch of which she was unsure. Rieu got up, gave the sick man a drink, and sat down again. Footsteps rang on the pavement, nearing, then receding. People were taking advantage of the lull to hurry home. For the first time, the doctor realized that this night, without the clang of ambulances and full of belated wayfarers, was just like a night of the past. A plague-free night. It was as if the pestilence, hounded away by cold, the street lamps, and the crowd, had fled from the depths of the town and taken shelter in this warm room and was launching its last offensive at Taru's inert body. No longer did it thresh the air above the houses with its flail, but it was whistling softly in the stagnant air of the sick room, and this it was that Rieu had been hearing since the long vigil began. And now it was for him to wait and watch until that strange sound ceased here, too,